Before we get started with today's show, be sure to check out ESPN Daily, our podcast that's putting out an episode every single weekday, rain or shine. Some good episodes this week are Kirk Goldsberry on how Michael Jordan would fare in the modern NBA and Jeff Passan updating MLB's plan to save the season. Subscribe to ESPN Daily and The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're going to be discussing Jordan and the Bulls' first championship with B.J. Armstrong on the Right Time Book Club here in a little bit. But remember to tune in to The Last Dance. The series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern. It was never going to be easy, of course, and the incredible challenge of winning a sixth title in 8 years and completing a second three-peat only grows more challenging the closer Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls get to the ultimate goal in the spring of 1998. It's the final two episodes of The Last Dance this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Catch up on every episode on demand and in the ESPN app. If you don't have access to ESPN, go to ESPNAccess.com to sign up today or listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast. Our coverage of The Last Dance is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about Tom Brady and Ahmaud Arbery. Also, The Right Time Book Club with B.J. Armstrong. But first, Major League Baseball is trying to figure out how to get itself back onto the field, get this money coming back in, and I don't feel cynical in saying that that's the thing. It's trying to get this money coming back in. I also am not really judgmental about people whose jobs it is to make money trying to get back out here and make money because their job is to go out here and get this money. But it is baseball, which means you ain't really getting nothing out of the Players Association without some measure of concession. They are here to fight. They've always been here to fight. And so the players are trying to get all their money. Now, management always has a great advantage at a time like this because they get to talk about how poor everybody else is, right? Like, it's this wildly disingenuous thing where the richest people involved look at the baseball players and then say, but you know everybody else is out here sacrificing. Ain't nobody in charge actually sacrificing here, right? Like, that's the big thing to think about. The big money, they might be losing money, but they're not really sacrificing money. Some of them might be like holding on to bottom line type stuff that's not necessarily in their favor because they're not laying people off. I guess there's a handful of folks, but they're not really looking at this truly as sacrifice. But everybody want to look at the players and they want them to sacrifice. And the players are like, yeah, I hear you. Let's talk this out a little bit more. And so this got us to Blake Snell. I don't know if you know this, but Blake Snell, A, plays for the Tampa Bay Rays, and B, has a Cy Young Award. I first became aware of him when he won the Cy Young. This seems to be happening to be more and more in baseball, the Cy Young in particular. What's Buddy's name that used to pitch for the Indians? Corey Kluber? I had never heard of Corey Kluber until he won a Cy Young, and they were in the playoffs. I don't know when this happened. It's not like I dislike baseball, right? I don't know when this happened. You asked me who won the Cy Young Award in 1989, I can tell you. You asked me who won the Cy Young Award in 2017, and I'm like, was that Blake Snell? I know it's in there somewhere. But anyway, Blake Snell was on Twitch, because that's what everybody's out here doing. They try to engage with y'all, you know, talk to y'all about stuff. And so he was on Twitch and he was talking about, you know, how he feels as a baseball player about the idea of coming back and some of the concerns that he has about coming back. And it sounds like this.
Bro, Blake, play for the love of the game, man. What's wrong with you, bro? Money should not be a thing. Bro, I'm risking my life.
Is that Blake Snell or Tony Snell?
He does have a really deep sounding voice, does he not?
Yo, like that does not sound like I expected Blake Snell to talk. Ladies and gentlemen, let us enjoy Blake Snell.
Money I signed to be getting paid. I should not be getting half of what I'm getting paid because the season's cut in half on top of a 33% cut of the half that's already there. So I'm really getting like 25%. On top of that, it's getting taxed. So imagine how much I'm actually making to play. You know what I'm saying? Like, I ain't making and on top of that, so all that money's gone. And now I play risking my life. And if I get the Rona, on top of that, if I get the Rona, guess what happens with that? Oh yeah, that's in my body forever. That damage is not going to be like the damage that was done to my body. That's going to be there forever. So now I got to play with that on top of that. So yeah. y'all got to understand, man. For me to take a pay cut is not happening because the risk is through the roof. It's a shorter season. No, I got to get my money. I'm not playing unless I get mine. Okay, and that's just the way it is for me. Like, I'm sorry if you guys think differently, but the risk is way the hell higher and the amount of money I make is way lower. Why would I think about doing that? Like, you know, I'm sorry. So in my head, I'm preparing for next season. I'm actually preparing for right now as if I'm preparing for next season. It's super weird, man. More Twitch streams for us, that's facts. But guys, I'm just saying, man, it just doesn't make sense for me to lose all of that money and then go play and then be on lockdown, not around my family, not around the people I love, and get paid way the hell less. And then the risk of injury runs every time I step on the field. So it's just not worth it. It's not. I love baseball to death. It's just not worth it.
Yo, interesting points. Great points all around. Gabe, was that the voice that you were expecting to get when you first pressed play on Blake Snell?
No, it was not.
I did not see that coming. I did not see that coming at all. I was surprised he didn't talk a little bit more actively with his hands. So I did a little Blake Snell research, right? Because I'm like, he got to be able to hoop, right? I need to know some more about where he's from, what his crew was, or whatever it is. So I went to the wiki page for his high school, because that is normally a good place for you to like get to the answers on these things. And nah, the famous alumni from his high school, it's like Chris Cornell from Soundgarden, rest in peace. A couple of the dudes from Alice in Chains. We got some soccer players. We got a professional Overwatch player. He's from Seattle, by the way. Jamal Crawford, Nate Robinson. They went to a different school, Gabe. They did not go to the school that this particular gentleman went to. Who is he? Where did this happen? Where was he radicalized? Who is he hanging out with like in the present day that's allowing him to maintain his practice at this tone? I have all the questions. Maybe he did the college thing, but I don't feel like you're going to be hanging out with a lot of black folks on the college baseball team. It appears that he, nah, straight out of high school. I don't know where this came up. Somebody in my mentions said they want to see his prom picture because they know he got a ball fade and a charming young African-American lady on his arm. I think it's totally possible. He had all these deep points, and I am just like skipping over all of those and just getting to the part that we find to be entertaining. I will say this, though, about the points that he made, because I feel like it's germane to this. We should talk about it. Hey, if he says he doesn't feel comfortable doing it, then that's that. You know, like I thought that he made a fairly compelling point because on one level, you're going to have a hard time convincing people that you're going to go to work half the time and therefore you should get 100% of the money. Like most people are just not going to buy that argument. What he seems to be saying, though, which I think is fair. Yeah, we're playing half the games, but in effect, he's talking about like hazard pay. You know, you're putting us into a particularly vulnerable position. Therefore, we should keep our money. And there's an argument that the owners should pay them in spite of just because the owners got to keep this thing going for when it is back to running on all cylinders. You know, like all these things, there's something to what he's talking about. He also made a point, and this is something that I think is lost in the larger national discourse, not just the one about sports when it comes to talking about this virus. People seem to act like just as long as it doesn't kill you, it's no big deal, right? Like the continuum of outcomes is treated as have no symptoms or die. And as long as you don't die, then they're treating it as like, okay, it's just this thing that you're going to have for a little while and you got to shake off. This stuff is doing like permanent damage, apparently, to people's lungs, you know, like people's lung capacity is being permanently altered, which, you know, really big deal if you are going to be a professional athlete, right? It can't just be, okay, you lived. Yay, way to go. There's a lot more that's going on with it. As I read more about this, and I'm honestly reading less now than I had before, because I'm just like, I just don't want to get it. Like, no matter what I know about what it might do to me, me reading it ain't going to change whether I get it or not or how I am personally affected. Like, I wish that if you got it, you could be like, but hold up, I've read everything. And the virus be like, okay, cool. You showed me some respect. I'm going to chill out. I ain't got to tell you about my gangster, right? I ain't got to show you my gangster. I wish that it was like that. Not really how it works. But the only thing I feel like I know about this virus is that I don't know nothing about this virus. That's it. You know, and I know there are people whose jobs it is to sound like they're in control and to sound like they have all the information and to sound like, in many cases, they know more than they actually do. I feel fairly confident saying all I know is that this is bad news. That's it. And so if anybody tells me that their response to this is, I don't want to put myself in a position to be around it. And if you're going to make me be in a position to be around it, you're going to have to pay me handsomely. I can't be upset with you about having that particular risk calculus. I just can't do it. Like, look, man, you got too many people that you see on television who are telling you that everything's cool while themselves taking every precaution possible. You know, like the people who are saying the most that it's all good, baby, you can go out here in these streets. I find it unlikely that many of them are actually going to be there. Like the places where these messages originate, those folks aren't out there kicking it the same way. That personally gives me pause about reentry into society and everything else. And with all the people that you got to be around in baseball and in the ways that you got to be around them, it makes me worry. Like we play those Korean baseball games right now on ESPN because South Korea seemed to have that thing under control. But they went from having that like nobody died today type stuff and it got real chill. And then they went back out there and then it started bubbling back again. I can't fault anybody who says they don't want to be the person that has to go out here and deal with this. I can't fault anybody that says they don't want to be in a position to be vulnerable. Now, this is an important part to me about like a cat like Snell. If Snell is saying, in order for me to pay, you got to give me all my money. If I don't play, then fine. Don't pay me. Boom. I'm with him. You know, like if that's what he says, I'm with him because that is the alternative. Like that's the next choice is like, you know, this is what you have to do to get this money. And if you can live with, all right, well, holler back at me when I can come out here and get this money safely, then there's no argument that anybody can have against that man. He's willing to make the trade off, right? He's not doing necessarily what you would do, but he's willing to make the trade off. And if he's willing to do that, then boom, there we go, right? But I will be very curious to see what the owners are going to have to do with the players to get this done. Because one thing about this is in times like these, people who got money see opportunity. Like this is a chance for them to come up in times like these because they can play the long game. You know what I mean? Like you think about people that's got a lot of money that do the investing and stuff like this. Stock market right now looks like it's okay. If that thing bottoms out, rich people are like, cool, I'm going to just put more money into this thing, come up off that, and then eventually get my money back on all the other stuff. Because for them, they see opportunity. And with the baseball owners, what they also see in part is an opportunity to get a salary cap. They see an opportunity to do this by means of revenue sharing as opposed to the kind of free market Wild West situation that they have as things stand presently. When you think about things in this kind of context, you got to look at the players and understand why they don't trust none of it. They don't believe none of it. Nah. So pay him or don't. And if he's willing to sit down, I don't know what you mad at. Ain't like you watching the Devil Rays or they ain't even the Devil Rays no more. Clearly, I don't watch the Devil Rays neither. All right. To the stuff that's not necessarily fun, but I think is noteworthy. I think a lot of you are familiar with the story of Ahmaud Arbery. He's a young man who was 26 years old. He was jogging in Brunswick, Georgia, a town way south in Georgia. And while he was jogging, he was pursued by people who lived in the neighborhood, chased down and shot to death. You are welcome to Google the particulars of that case. There's nothing I can tell you that's going to make it any different than what you see or read. I did not watch the video as there was video because quite honestly, I just don't do that anymore. But you can go check out what's going on there. The video became widely available for people to see. I want to say on May the 7th is when it really started bouncing around. On May 8th, the Players Coalition, which was the group that was formed in partnership with the NFL on the heels of Colin Kaepernick and the protests and all the things that he started, Malcolm Jenkins, Anquan Boldin, those guys, they have the Players Coalition. And the Players Coalition wrote a letter to the Department of Justice asking that the FBI take over the case. It's one of these where the local authorities weren't really investigating, right? You know, and so they asked the FBI to get involved in the case. There were over 50 people who signed the letter. Some of them, by the way, some interesting names. Steve Kerr's name is on the letter. Stan Van Gundy signed the letter. You had some former players, Sean Alexander, former NFL MVP. His name is on the letter. There were also over 20 New England Patriots who signed the letter. I believe the McCourty twins are heavily involved in that. Julian Edelman is someone who signed the letter. And a guy who no longer plays for the Patriots signed the letter, and his name is Tom Brady. And I am very interested in two things when it comes to Tom Brady signing that letter. Number one, the mere fact that he did something so intentional, right? Like the fact that he signed that letter at all surprises me. And number two, I guess number two is not surprising, but it's something that I want to talk about, which is we will make a full day of news out of anything that Tom Brady does. We'll talk for days about Tom Brady accidentally walking into the wrong house. You know, we'll get on TV and talk about Tom Brady putting it on Instagram that he's working out in his backyard wearing shoulder pads. Tom Brady puts his name on this letter and we don't really talk about it that much, you know? Now, like, you know, I'm on the emails when the new stories come around. It got to me, right? ESPN.com had it high up on his list of top headlines when this happened, but I still feel like there are a lot of you who are hearing this for the first time from me. And we all got to admit that's kind of backwards, right? Like, it's backwards on a number of levels. It's backwards, of course, on the level that, as I said before, we talk about everything else Brady does, how this wouldn't be a big deal, number one. Number two, I would think that it would jump off the page as news just because this would seem to move in contrast with that hat he left in that locker that one time that we will never fully know his intentions on, but it didn't seem to be unintentional. And so we spent a lot of time, I think media did, asking him about that and trying to get an answer out of him about that one, which I think was a legitimate thing for people to do. And maybe there'll be another opportunity to do it with this matter, but I'd like to know more about why Tom Brady decided to put his name on this. Like, a dude who has avoided controversy at every turn made the decision to put his name on something that is decidedly controversial in the eyes of a lot of people. You know, like a lot of folks, I when I mentioned this on Twitter a couple of days ago, somebody was like, this is a layup for Tom Brady. Ain't really no such thing as a layup when it comes to sticking up for black people in public. Like, not on something like this. There really aren't that many layups. But this is why I wish all parties involved would say a little bit more about this. What I have worried about when it comes to the Players Coalition is that the NFL is in partnership with them, but largely through money, right? Like, they're throwing some cash in their direction. It's a donation in large part. Now, the Players Coalition has gotten some good placement. Like, they had a Super Bowl spot. I mean, like, PSAs, I guess, would be a better way to put it. But they had those. Like, I don't want to pretend as though the NFL as a league has totally ignored the work that the Players Coalition has done, but I don't think that it's necessarily publicized like in some ways that should matter. Like the bill that passed in Florida by getting felons their right, the right to vote. The Players Coalition was heavily involved in that. By the way, Stan Van Gundy was also heavily involved with that, but the Players Coalition did that. Like, there's work that they are getting done, but I have always felt and believed that the best that the Players Coalition can do is going to happen when the league put some of his credibility down with this. Not just his money, not just his logos, but when you get some real big, important, significant names, then they decide they want to come stand behind this. And I mean white people specifically, right? When you got some big white names that come out and they say, hey, this is important, just like it's important that we raise awareness about cancer, just like it's important that we support the military. That's when I think you have the potential to really make something happen, because the NFL's money is cool. The NFL's platform is cool. But the affection that people have for the NFL does that transfer over to the way that people look at the causes that the Players Coalition supports? Now, I have always felt, when we talked about this when it first came around, that the messaging from the NFL, or the language that they use when they talk about the Players Coalition, is they talk about it as, we want to help these guys do things to help their communities. Where I believe the NFL's messaging should be, we want to do something to help America, right? Like, it needs to be positioned as though you're doing something for your fellow citizens, as opposed to, this isn't actually our problem, so we're going to help these guys fix what is their problem over there. No. Somebody like Brady, who is the establishment at this point, right? Like, he's not an NFL owner, but he is as close to that as a player can be in terms of the respect that he commands generally. Somebody like him putting his name on it, even if he's not in a commercial or anything like that, the fact that he puts his name on it is lending his credibility to the matter, right? And there is a certain measure of risk for him in this. And I say that because it don't take much for somebody to look at one of these cases and find their escape hatch, right? So the way the story went about this dude is, somebody claimed there had been like some string of robberies or something like that. And so they were on the lookout for the robber. And so they saw the guy jogging and they thought that he might be the robber. He didn't have like sacks of stuff over his shoulder or anything, but they thought that he might have been the bandit who had been robbing people. That's what they say. A few days later, you get a video that comes out of the dude walking around a construction site, like while nobody was there, which I guess is presented to give credence to the idea that maybe, you know, there was reason to think that he was, in fact, the robber. You can decide whether or not that's credible, right? That's enough for a lot of people to be like, oh, see, this isn't a thing. And then to look at people like Brady, even though all he did was put his name on a letter, then look at people like Brady and be like, see, we said wait for the facts. He was like, actually, I was trying to ask somebody else to go get some facts. But that don't matter, right? Like, people are not logical about these things. People are not rational about these things. That's why people like Brady typically stay away from these things, because it's not as though we're dealing with good sense when we deal with people about these things, right? That's not really how it goes. But he's putting his credibility in a way on the line by putting his name down on this thing, okay? That doesn't make him some kind of hero necessarily, but you should probably give more attention to the whole matter, because things are going to get done when somebody like Tom Brady can trade on his visibility, to trade on the respect that he receives, to give attention to this larger cause, right? That's the best chance you got for getting something to happen, is somebody in a position that he's in using that to bring more attention to something else. Are y'all deciding that you're just going to ignore this? Right? That of all the Tom Brady things, of all the irrelevant things that we can worry about when it comes to him and what he does, now's going to be the time that you turn your head away. Now's going to be the time that you don't pay any attention to it. Tom Brady says, hey, it looks like something really messed up might have happened down there, and the local authorities don't seem to want to investigate it. FBI, you should look into this, right? Now you don't want to listen? Now Tom Brady's not a star? Now what Tom Brady does doesn't matter? That doesn't make any sense at all, unless what you're saying is this cause intrinsically does not matter. What he's talking about here is something that does not concern me. I am not concerned with it, right? So again, I can't blame you if you didn't know that Brady put his name on it. And if you're the type of person who did not know about this story and you believe in Tom Brady in such a way that you hear him talk about something, you're going to go check it out. Okay? Then you should go ahead and do that. But my industry and everybody else, when Tom Brady puts his name on something like this, we should treat him like he's Tom Brady. You know how it is that we treat Tom Brady. You know, when Tom Brady don't, here's the thing about it. Like with the hat, for example, the Make America Great Again hat. And I said that he got some questions about it, but he got but so many, right? Like, people were looking for reasons to move on from that one. Okay. He didn't want to talk about that anymore, so we didn't talk to him about it anymore. He has demonstrated that he wants somebody to talk about this. So why don't y'all do what y'all always do and do what Tom Brady wants and talk about it? And if your answer is, I'm not sure why, you might know. Not throwing shade at you necessarily. Just saying, maybe, just maybe, this would be time for a little bit of introspection. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is our fourth episode of the Right Time Book Club. This year we are reading the Jordan Rules, but look at the 1990-91 season for the Chicago Bulls. We've had J.A. Adande on. We've had Vinny Goodwill of Yahoo Sports. Last week we had Joe Dumars, and this week joining us, he's three-time champion with the Bulls. He is now the executive vice president, managing executive of the Wasserman Agency basketball division, B.J. Armstrong. My man, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Pleasure. Hope you are doing well. Everyone staying safe. And thank you again for having me on.
Oh, dude, no problem. But now for my day one people, I have to tell you this story because they've heard me tell this story and everybody's going to love it. So in the early 90s, while you guys were running things, my brother was cool with a bunch of dudes from Chicago. And they got this story that they had crashed some party they're not supposed to be in. They're underdressed when they get there. And they're like, all right, so what's our plan for when, you know, how are we going to stick around here? And they said, all right, well, you're B.J. Armstrong. And so they decided that one of these dudes was going to be B.J. Armstrong. Except the problem is, like, in the early 90s, being B.J. Armstrong, that's a big deal, right? So it starts getting around the party like, yo, B.J. Armstrong is here, right? They just there lounging, yo, it's B.J. Armstrong. Yo, it's B.J. Armstrong. Yo, it's B.J. Armstrong. And then out of nowhere, one dude pops up and goes, what? That ain't no goddamn B.J. Armstrong. And so now the wheels have come off the plan. And so one of them was like, all right, I'll figure it out. He's like, hey, 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 he may not be B.J. Armstrong, but he's my boy. To which the response was, hey, who the f*** are you? So just so you know, being B.J. Armstrong can get you somewhere until they realize that you were not B.J. Armstrong.
Well, I'm sorry I caused you all those problems.
I'll tell you, that is gold standard story in my life. So now that we got past the warm-up portion of the process, B.J. Armstrong story time before we get to Sam Smith's story time. And for you, when the book came out, what was that like being on the team?
Well, you know, that was kind of the first time where I remember it wasn't like disruptive, but it was like, okay, the thing that we hold most sacred, which is our place in the locker room, our place together, that had, you know, suddenly now that was being threatened in a sense. But I think the guys, or at least my feeling was, is I was still committed to making sure that we finished what we came here to do. And, but you know, I think we understood it. I think we understood that what celebrity and, you know, winning and being a champion is all about. And that for the first time that there were outside forces trying to figure out what was going on internally. But we were able to withstand that. I think everyone understood what was going on. And then we were able to persevere and eventually continue and win a championship that year in 93.
Yeah. Also, at least my conclusion for reading it, I didn't feel like anybody really came out of it looking that bad, though. That would be something I'd be very nervous about before it came out. But I didn't come away from that feeling like, wow, anybody was a bad person or anything like that.
No, I mean, at the time, I didn't read it at that time. But the thing that we had all done then, and here we are 30 years later, and we're still recounting those stories because people, we understood that as a group. And even though there were some things that came out in the book, you know, we still felt that, you know what, we can figure out how to, you know, hold this thing together. So, you know, it is what it is. That's part of the territory. And but we had a team full of professionals. So, you know, it was kind of business as usual for us.
Yeah, and I think there are a couple things that jumped out from this passage that like particularly involved you. One of them was the idea of you going to read books on geniuses to try to relate better to Michael Jordan. Did that work?
Well, I don't know how effective it was. I was, you know, I just wanted to keep myself intellectually, you know, challenged, I guess, in the NBA. It's not like we were doing anything that was spectacular as far as you learn your plays, you learn your schemes, and you just kind of repeated it, you know, every single day. So I thought it was a great opportunity for me to understand something that I hadn't seen before, which was I saw a player who was playing with a level of creativity. He had an imagination in the way he played. And, you know, and when you read it, you know, you figure, you know, you just kind of do things, right? You know, you do a layup or you focus on the fundamentals of the game. And suddenly I saw a player that had a very creative way about going about his business. And he wasn't like most players where he would play, you know, me versus you and the matchup that, you know, you have to take every single night. He was playing against one versus two, one versus three, in some instances, one versus the team. You know, there were rules how to play. So I just thought it was very creative. He had an imagination. And I just took it upon myself to try to understand how could a person ascend to something that was like very methodical, right? You know, you play the game, you start the game, you go through your routine. And suddenly he was doing things and doing it in a very creative way. And my mom had given me some books and things to read because she always wanted me to keep myself kind of, you know, stay sharp. And that was one of the books I was reading at the time.
I think one of the things that The Last Dance has kind of missed about Jordan is the intellect portion of it, right? Because like, right. I've tried to find generally the flaw in him as basketball player, and it's almost impossible to come up with. But lost in it, I think, is he was a really, really smart basketball player. And I think that's something that I could imagine playing with him is kind of be also kind of daunting, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, as good as he was physically, because he had incredible physical gifts, intellectually, he was a master at really understanding the game of basketball. And when you talked with him, he not only knew what he was supposed to do, he knew what you were supposed to do. He knew what the team was supposed to do. He knew the rules and, you know, what the opposing team was trying to do defensively. And he just had a phenomenal understanding of the game. And I think that's the one thing that, you know, people don't really talk about with him is intellectually he was a master of the game of basketball. He really embraced the lifestyle. He was what I refer to as a basketball lifer. That's what he was. That's what he did. And along with his physical gifts. And when you put the two together, this is what you get. It's Michael Jordan.
And then the flip side, though, I guess, is sometimes it can be a little hard to deal with.
You know, I keep hearing that I didn't find him hard to deal with, you know, because when you find someone who loves the game, when you find someone who truly loves it, then I didn't get, and I still don't get, as I'm hearing that, I never came home and said he's hard to play with. You know, when you say Michael Jordan, there's only one other word that you really can put next to it, and that's winning. So what was the other agenda other than he was going to do what he needed to get done to get to that point? And the thing that I always respected about him was, and I think he said it in the documentary, was, I'm not going to ask you to do something that I'm not going to do myself.
Well, one thing I do seem to notice is that the people who push back at Mike seem to be the ones that he liked, right? Like the people that took it, he didn't seem to have much for, but you're an example of this. We got, you know, Horace Grant is another guy that if you push back, it seemed that that was something that he respected.
You know, what I always found it with anyone is, especially with that group, we had a lot of strong personalities with that group. And whether it was Bill Cartwright, you know, he was quiet, but he, you know, he understood and he had the respect of the team. And we had great veterans and John Paxson and, you know, Scotty and Horace were young. And I just never had a problem with, you know, Michael and what he was doing, because we were a group. We actually, in my opinion, when you achieve that level of success, we are actually policing ourselves. And the one thing that I don't think anyone realizes is that he could also take it. He could take that. We were each other's truth teller. So if Michael saw something that I was doing and I needed to correct, then he would say it, but vice versa. So it was never personal. It was just with the idea that we were trying to win. And I've been on good teams. I've been on some teams that weren't as successful. And if you're going to be successful in that league, you have to be truth tellers. And we were a team that was committed to being truth tellers. So to me, it was nothing out of the ordinary to say that, because our relationship was built on the foundation of trust. And if you're going to play and you're going to win, then you have to make yourself vulnerable. And that's what we did. And so I never had a problem with any of the guys telling me their truth, because that's what it was all about.
Well, one thing I thought that was interesting in reading this book, and we were talking to Vinnie Goodwill about it, is he thought it was interesting for him to go back and read it and be like, oh, so NBA teams are all the same. And what he meant was just that you have all these combinations of interest in different people and everything else. And he had primarily covered teams that were bad, but a lot of the characteristics that are there on those teams are also on the teams that win, right? Like, it's always going to be something.
Yeah, it's, well, playing in the NBA, and once I left the Bulls, I found this out, like, winning covers a multitude of sins. Every team has the same exact problems, except when you win, they just get swept under the rug. So, you know, if you're going to win, you got to find a way. You have to be committed to do what you need to do no matter what. That's the difference between the good teams and the teams who don't win, is you just find a way. So every team is going to have problems. You have, you know, problems with, you know, guys, some guys may feel they want more shots. Some guys may feel they want to be involved in different plays, or they want to be utilized in a different way. That's fine. But when you get on the court, what separates those groups are the professionalism that's required. And once we got in between the lines, anything that was going on outside of it really didn't matter to us.
Now, and in this season, the book characterizes it as you had reached that point in your career where you would like to have more shots.
Well, it wasn't more shots. It's just that if you're going to play, then play, right? You can't just have, like, you know, when you're out there playing, if I'm playing against, like, say, a top guard in the NBA, that guard is going to come at me, right? You want to be able to compete as well. And, you know, that's just a part of the nature of competition. So in the end, you had to understand what was going on. And the thing that I was very lucky, because when I came to that team, is that I came into a good team, and that team was already on its path and already on its journey. And the journey was, I didn't have the opportunity to figure out as a young player what I was going to be in the league. I had to figure out what I could do to help a team win immediately when I came into the league. And that's a lot different. So it was just a matter of me understanding and finding my path, finding what I needed to do. And I had, you know, I had veterans. I had people like Scotty. I had people like Michael that I could talk with and help me to understand that, you know what, this is what we need you to do at this moment in time. Like most young players, you come in this league and you try to find out what you can do. But that wasn't the case when I came into that team, because that team was ready to win.
Now, what was your relationship with Phil through all of this?
You know, Phil's first year was my first year, and, you know, Phil had a lot of pressure. I didn't have a problem with Phil as far as what we were doing. It was that Phil never really said anything. Like, he never, when I said anything, Phil never, like, came to me and said, BJ, this is your role, or BJ, this is what we expect of you. You know, Phil was one, he kind of let you find your way. And as a young player, you know, coming in my first year, we're in Game 7 of the conference finals, you know, so I was just learning on the job. So, he had different pressures. I had different pressures. And we didn't really, you know, have this relationship where we were talking and communicating, so forth and so on. But he let me find my way. And I think many times we were all trying to, especially myself, I was trying to find my way. And probably, if anything, I probably wanted to have more communication with him. But that was fine. I figured it out. We moved on. So I didn't have a problem with Phil. And anyone who's played for Phil knows that Phil is, you know, he kind of keeps his distance. And I can respect that. I understand it. But as a young player, you know, you have a lot of questions. So, but I had great veterans to help me along the path. And I was able to kind of settle in and figure out what I needed to do to be a professional as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the distance, because I think from where a lot of us sit, we imagine Phil with all his various outlooks and poking here and poking there and trying to figure out how to get you guys to the place where you are. And I could imagine, at least from here, that I can see how that could get old kind of quick once you realize that this is what that person does.
Well, yeah, I mean, Phil is, you know, he understands, you know, kind of group dynamics, if you will. So it was very important for us, if we were going to be a great team, that we had to kind of pull each other along. And that's where the leadership comes in. You know, he wasn't going to allow the team to rely on him. And if you ever watch a Phil Jackson team, he's not going to call timeouts. He's not going to bail you out if things are going rough. He's okay with letting things get a little rough a little bit. So, again, it just took me a little time to adjust to it. I hadn't been in a situation like that before. But once I kind of understood the environment that I was in, you know, I adjusted, took on my responsibility because I knew what the guys expected of me, and then we moved on.
Now, what was it like for you to be on the team that finally conquered the Pistons?
I tell you, you know, that was the first time, losing to the Pistons in 1990 in Game 7 was probably one of the, it was my defining moment, you know, as I look back of my career, because I understood then when I lost to the team that if I was going to move on to the next step, I was going to have to pour everything that I had in my soul to this task. The Detroit Pistons were, they weren't a good team. They were a great team. They were mentally tough. They had Hall of Fame players. They had a Hall of Fame coach. And as good as they were individually, they were that much better as a team. They had a Hall of Fame player coming off the bench and Dennis Rodman. They were really, really good. So I had to make a choice then and there in that moment in that locker room to make us a change in my life. And the change had to be either I was all into this or I was just going to make an excuse of why we couldn't beat the Detroit Pistons. So I remember sitting there because I wasn't going to beat them with talent. We weren't going to overwhelm them, even though we may have had the best player on the floor. They had the best team. And it was going to require us to utilize our best player with the great players that we had and Scottie Pippen and so forth. We were going to have figure this out. We needed to do that together. And it required me to be vulnerable. I couldn't just go out and take on my matchup and just win my matchup. I had to have a way to think about the game because intellectually, the Pistons were a fabulous team. And they mentally, they were a tough group. And that was the first time that I had to look at myself and say, okay, I have to be committed to every other guy at the hip. I got to be connected to every guy, to what they're doing. And if we're going to do this, this is one that's going to require all of us to really have a way to think about the game because they were as tough mentally as that I've seen. And I've always had the utmost respect for them when we played them. So to beat them and defeat them was something that I know the difficulty because I've been on the other side. You know, you win and you lose, but you learn that really there's no difference. Because you have to respect the group that you're playing against.
Well, and I think there's another level that I didn't realize until I started researching for this, that you are from Detroit.
Yeah, I'm from Detroit. So I grew up, you know, watching those guys. I remember in 81 when they drafted Isaiah Thomas. I remember when they drafted Joe Dumars. And I, you know, for all of us who grew up in Detroit, you know, that team embodied who we were, you know, the bad boys, so forth and so on. You know, I like to always tell the story, you know, during those times, my parents would tell me, hey, we hope you do well, but we hope the Pistons win. I mean, that was my whole family. So I understood that. I understood what that Detroit team meant to the city of Detroit. And, you know, growing up there as a young kid, you know, I looked up to the Pistons and I looked up to see how they was making progress. But when it came time to play them, you know, I had to figure out what I needed to do and be a professional and play and overcome that as well.
So you guys get past the Pistons. You win the series against the Lakers. Now you are champions, right? Like the moment that you realized you were an NBA champion for you, how did that feel?
I remember when we won. It was when I first realized that if I was, you know, what I thought I was going to feel didn't happen. I used to always ask myself as a kid, why come everyone cries when they win a championship? You know, like, because if I ever was to win a championship, I'm just going to be celebrating. It's going to be fun. And when I won, you're overcome with this sense of like, you know, I don't know. It's like emotion. I have no idea. I can't explain it because it had never happened before. But you feel all of the losses, you feel all of the workouts, you feel all of the things that got you to that point. And then suddenly when we won, I remember I had this feeling of I can't be happy. I couldn't trust being happy. You know, being happy meant that I was going to get comfortable. I was going to get complacent because I knew then everything that I did to get to this point and I didn't want to give it up. I wasn't ready to give it up. So I remember I was like, okay, if I'm here, there's some young guy that had the same feeling that I've had the year before, right? That's right. Trying to get after me. And that next year, we were better in 92 than we were in 91. And I think everyone kind of, I don't know if everyone felt that, but I certainly had this feeling of never trust happiness. So I became really consumed with making myself as uncomfortable as I possibly could. And I've always kept that with me. Like, I'm comfortable being uncomfortable. If I'm comfortable, I don't want to be there. I just want to be uncomfortable because I always want to disrupt myself. I always want to keep myself on edge. So that was my thought process then. It's kind of like my little secret that I've always carried with me is to never get comfortable. I remember that's what I felt, and that's how I began to work from that point moving forward.
Well, how much did it improve your confidence? Because one thing Jordan is saying in this documentary, that a big part of this is the confidence of knowing that you can do it.
Well, yeah, it's one thing to talk about it. It's one thing to think you can do it, but it's another thing to go out there and execute it. So the execution of any idea to me is the brilliant part of actually going out there and completing the task. So now we were there. Now we saw it and we experienced it for ourselves. And once we experienced, you know, getting through our own, you know, I remember game one with the Lakers. That was our first year in the finals. We all were a little nervous, but we quickly got over our nerves and we quickly got over the excitement of just getting there to like why we were there. We were there to first establish that we were there to fight. Then we were established that we were there to win. And then we eventually were able to execute it. So the execution of it is great because now you have an understanding of what needs to be done. You understand, you know, back then it was a 2-3-2 format. You know, you understand how to play in that format as compared to a 2-1-1-1. So you begin to have this inner confidence of saying, I know what needs to be done, and you pick and choose your opportunities when they present themselves. So we were a very confident group that way.
Right, now, I want to ask you a couple questions about things I had seen in The Last Dance. One of them being with the press conference where Michael retired in 1993. Do you enjoy as much as we do seeing you with the Lokes on and the White Sox hat looking like Eazy-E posted up on the side?
Well, I'm going to tell you, all of my friends, they called me immediately after that. They was like, that's you. That's how we, you know, I grew up in Detroit and I'm a huge music fan and, in particular hip hop. And, so whether it was, you know, West Coast, East Coast, I just love the music. I love the culture. You know, Motown was, that's what we had in our house. And so me growing up with hip hop, that was me. That wasn't me trying to, you know, that's how we dressed. That's how we did. And I loved it. I loved it. And it's really funny. Because everyone called me and said the same exact thing.
Because I realized, I guess I had not seen you in street clothes before, but it's one of those people who are like, yo, who's your man? Who'd you bring over here? That's BJ. Oh, that's his name, BJ? Nah, man, that's BJ. BJ, number 10.
Yeah, so, you know, whether, like I said, you know, Ice Cube and Dr. Dre or, you know, on the East Coast, you know, KRS-One and G-Rap and, right, you know, Grandmaster Caz. I mean, I could go on and on. That's how I grew up. So, you know, I love the music. I love the culture and I still follow it to this day. So, you know, that's my thing. I'm going to always stand up and represent the culture and knowing what that music meant to me as a young man and so many other people around the world.
Well, I also wonder for you, like, I think people probably make a lot of assumptions about you in whatever direction just based on the baby face, right? Like I think that you ask people, I think Steph Curry deals with this to a degree too, that people look at him and see the young face and they don't actually know anything about him, but you start like putting things on him because of what you see.
Yeah, you know, for sure. You know, people see me and, you know, I've always had this young face and I, you know, my parents look young. And so that's where I got that. But again, I mean, I grew up right in the city. I grew up, you know, I mean, that's just how it was. I mean, hip hop was a part of my life and it is a part of my life. It's a part of, you know, who I am. And, you know, growing up there, I remember when Jay Dilla and all of those people was coming out of Detroit. And like I said, You know, it's kind of funny. Because my kids now, they were like, Dad, what were you doing with your hat and your glasses and all of your things? So it was funny, though.
Another thing was I'd forgotten before watching it about in the 98 Eastern Conference semifinals playing against the Hornets, and you guys had that game. And I wonder for you, the moment that you realize, oh, Mike's not going to be happy about this. Like, we're getting that other Mike the next game.
Well, I want to say this, right? I'm going to say this and share this. You know, when I came into this league, you know, there was a certain way that you had to, you know, you had to conduct yourself and carry yourself because intimidation was a real thing, right? People were going to try you. And I learned this immediately when I came into the NBA. You know, if you're going to play, and I learned this from Michael. Michael would always say, if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down with nothing left. I'm going to go down with nothing left. And when you come into a playoff series, you got to establish immediately in this series that you are there to fight. You got to establish that. That's rule number one. That's rule number one. If I didn't do that, what I did in that series, I would have gotten a call from every player, in particular, Michael Jordan, would have called and said, what are you doing? Because I didn't know any other way other than try to win the series or win the game. If I didn't do it, Michael Jordan, without question, would have called and said, what are you doing? That's not you. Because that's not the mindset of what we all stood for.
Right.
Now, so I had a choice. Either I was going to fight and I was going to get that call, or I was going to get that call from Michael and he was going to be upset, or I was going to not fight and get that call. So I did the only thing that I knew how to do then, and the only thing I know how to do now, which is, yeah, I may lose. That's probably, I may lose. But if I get in the right punch, I might win. Okay? Now, I learned that from him. I learned that. You can't be in this league with fear. And I was going to play fearless. Now, talent and all those things, look, it is what it is. But if you're in a fight and you get in the right punch, you might win. You might just, you might get the right punch in. It might be your day. And that's how you play. That's why you compete. You can't go out there worried about winning and losing. You got to go out there and give it your all. That's why it's funny to me then. It's funny to me now because you know what? That's what you did. You, every single day you come out there, it might be your day. It might be your day. So as much as, yeah, probably, you know, Michael was going to do what he had to do, but there have been many days in practice, I got my shot in. And there's many days of practice. I won some of them games, too. He didn't win all of them.
Right.
I won some of them. So that's why you compete. Now, clearly, I knew what was going on. He knew what was going on. But that's why you play. And that's what was fun about it. And then, you know what? You know what's really funny is that we could still laugh about it. We could still laugh. So it was funny. You play, you work hard, but I want to keep everybody sharp. He was keeping me sharp. I was keeping him sharp. And afterwards, you move on because competition, that's what this league is really all about.
Now, I want to ask you, in your current capacity where you are a player agent, what's the world like with COVID-19 as a player agent right now?
Well, it's been, like most, it's been, you know, things have really been disrupted. We don't really know, you know, what this is going to really look like when we come back. If anything, in trying to gather the information, there's going to be a new normal, right? And we don't know what that new normal is going to be. What is sports going to look like when we all come back? The communities and things in which all of these players play in, you know, everyone's trying to figure out, you know, their safety, not only for the teams, but safety for themselves, their families. You know, can we play? Are we going to play with fans there? Are we going to play in strategic locations? No one really knows. And so this has been one of those, probably one of the most unique things I've ever experienced, because not only do I represent players here in the United States, but players all around the world. And when you see different countries, the reactions, what's going on, it's been something to see, because everyone has been affected by this. Everyone has had someone that's, you know, been close by. And so the safety of all has been first and foremost for all, right? Because, you know, you have families, you have kids, and we're going to have to figure out the risk reward of this, you know, coronavirus, you know, because right now we currently don't have a cure and we currently don't have a vaccine. So I know everyone wants to get back to their normal, whatever that normal may be. And in this case, you know, I know players want to play, but at the same time, it's been one that I can't say any of us have the answers at this time.
And I feel like it kind of plays a little different at the NBA right now. Like, it's a different discussion with baseball because the season is getting close to starting. And now we start looking at, like, most of the NBA checks have been paid for the 2019-2020 season. Baseball, yes. These are new checks. And yes. They're like, hey, yeah. So what are we about to do?
Right, right. Yeah. So, and that's the business of it. So, I would begin to think that, hey, look, everyone wants to try to figure out what this could look like. Because once you do start, whenever that may happen, right, whether it's, 6 weeks from now or 8 weeks, whenever, or maybe it's into next season, what you don't want to do is stop once you start again, you know. And so we'll see how that plays out. I think there's more information that needs to be gathered. I think what Adam Silver has done is I think he's kind of laid out strategically, and he's beginning to lay out strategically the possibilities. But in the end, I still think there's a lot more information we need to gather, and we'll see how that plays itself out here in the next 2 to 4 weeks. I think he just stated the other day.
Like, just generally being an agent, like, I'm assuming you enjoy it because you still do it. But, like, how do you feel about just the experience of being on that side of it after spending so many years playing?
Well, I was always that curious kid. And, playing, I got a chance to see some things that no one really prepared me for. I got a chance to see the business side of this. You know, everyone was like, oh man, you want to play and you want to work on your game. And then suddenly when I got here, I started looking around. I go, well, why is that Budweiser sign over there? And why are we playing these games at this time? Why do we play 4 times a week? You know, how are they, you know, scheduling all these arenas, so forth and so on. So I was just very curious. And then when I got done playing, I went and worked in the front office because I wanted to understand the business that I had just walked into. I walked into this business. Like, how did I get drafted? How do you really make a trade? You know, what is free agency? So I wanted to know the business side of this, because when I was playing, you know, I saw a player who was playing basketball, but he also was able to create a business. So it was the basketball business. Suddenly, when I ended playing, you know, games were on ESPN. Games were moving to cable television, DirecTV, and the explosion of the game was beginning to happen. And I worked in the front office because I wanted to know how this worked. Like, there was expansion. You know, I saw two expansions. I saw the Charlotte Hornets when they came in. And then the Orlando Magic. Then I saw Toronto Raptors. And at the time, it was the Vancouver Grizzlies before they eventually moved. So, you know, how are these teams able to capitalize and what were they doing? So I was that kid. And then that eventually brought me over here to the agent side. I probably should have known all along, you know, because, you know, I've always had an affinity for the players. And I had so many questions in my own mind as a young player of how this business works. And I think that's probably how I got here. I never intended to be an agent, but I just always wanted to know, like, all of these things. Like, how are they building these arenas? I remember when the Detroit Pistons built the Auburn Hills, you know, the Palace. Like, how did that happen? Like, how did they build these arenas? And why did they have these suites? And why were these big, you know, scoreboards there? So I was just intrigued about all of those things. And then suddenly there was an influx of, you know, foreign players were coming into the league and they were asking us to take trips abroad. So I was just looking around going, oh, this is a global thing. And then I had to figure out how it really worked, and I wanted to know how it really worked.
You know, that actually gets to something in the Jordan rules. Scottie Pippen signed the contract that later became the big thing in The Last Dance that caused him all of the problems. you were a player while it was going on. Now you are an agent and seeing what that was. I have been talking to people and I said, hey, man, Scotty made a trade. He decided to go long-term security and then the long-term wasn't as good as he wanted to be. So like as an agent, how do you handle a situation like that where the client wants something that you don't think is the best idea?
Well, you know, the business is constantly changing and, you know, look, without knowing all of the details and, you know, I never like to comment about something when I don't know the details, because now as an agent, you know, you can, it's easy to always to look back on something. Back then, the money and the things that we know now, you know, that wasn't the idea back then, right? You didn't play basketball and say, I could actually, you know, make enough money to possibly change my life and my family's life. That wasn't the type of money that we've come to see financially that we see today. The one thing I do remember about that time was that injuries were a part of the game. And I do remember that Scotty had an injury when he first came out, or early in his career, he had a back injury. So I don't know what that played in his thought process. It's easy now to say what happened, but when you have an injury as a young player, as you have an injury at any time, because you are going to get injured at some point in your career, that can have a drastic way you begin to look at life, right? So it's easy for me to say now what should have been happening, but when you're coming back from an injury like that, that has a significant way of thinking, because every player understands this. Everyone is always an ankle sprain away from it being over. Everyone. And coulda, woulda, shoulda, oughta sounds great after the fact. But when you're in that moment and you know that potentially things could change, you know, I represent a client like Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose was MVP and suddenly it changes like that. Life changes like that. Either way. And when you have a significant injury, I had, you know, everyone's asking me about three championships and everything with the Bulls, but no one's asked me about my six or seven surgeries that I had just to maintain and keep this thing on the track, you know, keep this train on the track. So when you have a significant injury and you have a surgery, like a back surgery as a young player, that's a game changer, because you don't know whether you will come back. And I'm not saying, you know, that was the reason why or what have you. But I do know I've been in that hospital and you don't know if you're going to come back. And I don't know what I would have done if I had, you know, a fusion on my back when I was, you know, 21, 22. It's no guarantee that you come back and your body responds. You don't know how your body's going to respond. So I get it. Scotty ascended to a place that we all thought he could. That's why they drafted him where they drafted him. But it's not a guarantee that you are, let alone you're going to win one championship, two. You know, the man went on to be one of the top 50 greatest players of all time. And in the end, what the Bulls did do was they did a sign and trade with Scottie Pippen.
Right.
And they didn't have to do that. I've been in this executive chair where when you do a sign and trade, no one requires you to do that. So whatever happened, happened. I just looked at it from afar. You know, I wasn't in the room, and there's always things, you know, in order to know what's going on, you got to be in the room. But what I do know is that, you know, every time I stepped out on the floor, I knew there was a chance it could be over and this thing could go one way. And so I always say this with great humility. It's fun to say it and looking on the couch and looking from the outside. But hey, every time I went in for surgery, there is a, because my body, that's how I live. And you just never know. Like I never knew every time I had a knee surgery whether I was going to come back. And as a guard, as you know, that's not a comfortable place to be in, because your whole game depends on speed and quickness. I remember having surgery one year and I saw Allen Iverson that year and I was like, I got to make a decision here, because that man is moving at a pace that I hadn't seen before. So these are the things that happen that you are confronted with. So, you know what? I see it. But in the end, I think the business of how it happened when Scotty, I think he went to Houston, I believe. I had already left the Bulls by then. Hey, it is what it is. No one can take that away. So you know what? I get what was said, but you got to, you know, you got to put it in its proper perspective and just try to see the whole picture instead of just that one little moment.
All right. That is BJ Armstrong, my man. Thank you so much for joining us with this, man. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate you. Y'all be good.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to BJ Armstrong for joining us on The Right Time Book Club. Next week, we will wrap it up with Sam Smith, the author of The Jordan Rules. Be sure to check that out. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.